Session number 9246, Major Ken Scott, Part 1.
When did you go to the Far East and how did you get there?
I left Cairo in end of January 1945. And the only way I could get home leave was to volunteer for the Far East. So they allowed me 2 weeks leave after 4 years in the Middle East. Went home, got married to my fiancée, and I was then posted to Mountbatten's headquarters in Kandy. And I was sent out in mufti, put on a train at Victoria Station, and picked up the flying boat in Poole Harbour, and had the most delightful journey to Karachi, and then eventually down to Kandy, and stayed in Kandy and or Colombo for perhaps 2 or 3 months while they organised our operation in Malaya.
What were you actually doing in that 2 or 3 months in Kandy and Colombo?
Jungle training and swimming, but quite intensive jungle training by the army.
How did you take to jungle training?
It was so vastly different from the experience in the Middle East. I really quite enjoyed it. The weather was gorgeous, which was a change from 3 or 4 feet of snow, and I really quite enjoyed it. Took to it very well.
What are the main differences in principle between the sort of training you need for mountain operations, such as you'd been doing, and the sort of training you need to survive and operate in jungle?
Mine's an absolute blank on it. It is an absolute blank on it, I'm afraid. I enjoyed it, I can remember, but I have virtually dismissed it from my mind. I can't remember, can't recall.
Were you training in a conventional way in infantry tactics, or was it specifically for small group operations?
No, it was the normal infantry training for jungle warfare. Nothing special at all, nothing associated with stealth activities or SOE activities. It was a normal infantry training.
Did you see much of Mountbatten's headquarters in action while you were doing this?
No, because the training was done down near the coast. So although I reported to Kandy and was basically stationed there, waiting for operation orders, my training was down on the coast.
What sort of operation did you think they were going to use you for?
The intention, when I got there, the intention was that we should be dropped in Malaya to keep the railway line closed between Siam and Singapore. At the moment, at that time, the Japanese were using it quite extensively for supporting their operations, and would be withdrawing, hopefully, on the invasion of Malaya. And our task was to keep the railway line cut.
What method were you going to use to accomplish that objective?
Bridges, tunnels, and the normal cutting of lines. We were to be dropped some way up from 100 miles or so up, I suppose, from the Malaya border. The railway line runs fairly near to the coast. There were bridges there, there were tunnels there, and it was our job to carry out a very extensive recce and then prepare a series of demolition plans to be put in action on instructions from Kandy.
Sounds very similar to the sort of thing you actually did in Greece.
I think that's why I was sent there, yes.
What were you told about the Japanese occupation forces?
Absolutely nothing until we were about to be given our operation order. But I think there was tremendous confusion at that time. I think this was round about the beginning of August, and the first atomic bomb was dropped in about the middle of August. And you can imagine there was utter confusion in the headquarters at that time.
What was your own reaction to the news of the atomic attack on Japan?
My first concern was whether or not we were going ahead with the operation. I had the experience, we'd been trained for it, I was anxious to go and do it. And my first concern was for the operation, because I had been appointed leader of the operation, and I had two or three chaps with me, and we all knew each other, we were all keen to go. And it was for the operation, really.
What sort of chaps did you have in your team?
I had Billy Stanley Moss, who was with me in Macedonia. He was the chap who was in the raid on Crete that captured the German general. And a fellow called Hibberdeen, who was an infantry captain and also a wireless operator. So there were three of us.
If you had gone in for your original purpose, was the idea that you would operate without local help, or was it expected that parties already inserted or locally recruited resistance would assist you?
I was supposed to be given a Siamese division, and I had a Siamese division under command as soon as I got there. That was the intention. And it was my job to organise the reconnaissance, draw up the demolition plans, and use this Siamese division to the best advantage to deal with the various operations.
It sounds like it was going to be a much more regular sort of operation than those in Greece, if you had a division.
Well, that was the hope and the expectation. But the Siamese are a little two-faced, and they can face two ways at the same time. In fact, if I remember rightly, when I got there, there was a Japanese mission attached to the division at the same time as the division was supposed to be under my command. Can you imagine anything more peculiar?
Well, it does sound rather similar again to Greek circumstances, where you were attached to the Andartes to a certain extent, and they were simultaneously dealing with their German opposite numbers.
It was to that extent quite similar, yes, yes.
When you got your op order, was it extensive, or was it a minimal sort of order?
No, it was a very detailed operation order. It covered, from memory, 20 foolscap pages. It gave the disposition of the enemy. It gave our requirements, methods of liaison, wireless contact. It was a fully detailed operation order.
On reflection, was the intelligence about enemy dispositions and numbers reasonably accurate?
As far as numbers are concerned, yes, but the dispositions were not known at all. It was up to us to find out and report.
Was this because the deployment of the Japanese was fluid?
I think so. Yes, I think so.
How did they actually insert you into Siam?
We flew to Rangoon, changed planes at Rangoon, and a Dakota was allocated to us, dropped us and our stores on a tin mine about 100 miles north of the Malaya border, on the east coast.
What sort of height did you jump from?
About 300 feet. On a clear evening in a wooded valley. And, as I say, it was a disused tin mine.
Was there anyone there to receive you?
Very well received by the commander of the Siamese division, by his staff, by the chief of police, and with an interpreter.
A full civic reception?
Full reception, followed by a gigantic party in the tin mine.
What was this tin mine like? Was it tunnels or was it open cast working?
It was tunnels adrift into the mountain, and a lot of old wooden buildings, disused, and a railway line leading down, a narrow gauge railway line leading down from the mine to a little port on the coast.
How large was this Siamese division which you had been given?
The 6th Independent Division, it was called, I remember. I think it consisted of 4 battalions. Whether it had any artillery and it had any sappers, I can't honestly remember. I think it was 4 battalions of infantry.
Did you become immediately aware that there was a Japanese mission attached to it, or did that information come to you later?
Well, we were told as soon as the time came for us to leave the mine and go to the divisional headquarters, we were told by the division general that he would prefer that we went into one particular area of the camp in a hut, because they still had the Japanese mission attached to their headquarters, which is a situation we accepted.
Did he show any sign of embarrassment when he gave you that advice?
None at all. Absolutely none at all, no. Both he and I were not aware of the Japanese reaction or what would happen if they knew. They were undecided, and that the Siamese were not able to assess what might have happened.
On the whole, do you think that the Siamese commander was more favourable to you than to the Japanese, or was
there reverse? Oh, certainly. By that time he realised the Japanese were defeated, and therefore there was no difficulty at all in switching his allegiance 100% to the Allies.
But it had nothing to do with an inherent preference. It was just a matter of advantage, was it?
Purely a matter of advantage, yes. Oh, yes. Certainly.
What opinion did you form of this man's character and his efficiency as a commander?
We never got down to any detail at all. We had no operations to carry out. He merely said, if there's anything you want me to do, you must please let me know and I will arrange it. And that was the extent of our contact.
When you arrived at this tin mine, was this before or after the Japanese surrender?
It was after the Japanese surrender. The bomb was dropped on the 14th of August, I remember, and we left Calcutta on the 21st of August for Rangoon, and we were dropped, I think, a couple of days later. 29th, I think.
So it was well into the post-surrender.
Well into the post-surrender, but there was no information in Kandy or in Siam of the Japanese reactions in that particular area, down in Malaya and Siam. No knowledge at all on what they might do.
How long were you in the tin mine before you moved up to the camp?
About 2 weeks. We had intermittent contact with headquarters, and we were advised by the commander of the Siamese division, who had returned to his headquarters, when he thought it was suitable for us to leave. So around about the 30th of August, we left with his liaison officer to go to his headquarters.
How did you occupy yourselves when you were in the mine for your fortnight?
Getting to know the local area and looking around the place. And it was so different from anything that we, the three of us, had seen before. We were just acclimatising ourselves, I think, to the local scene.
Were there any Japanese troops in the area?
No, none at all. None at all. We found out later that they were concentrating in 2 particular areas. In Songkla, somewhere near the border of Siam, and at Bandon, which was within 2 or 3 days' march of the tin mine.
Why was your contact with London intermittent? Was it trouble with the radio?
Contact with, not with London, but
with Kandy.
It was, yes, trouble with our radio. We lost various bits of it when it was dropped, and I think there was some essential part of it was missing. and we had contact, intermittent contact, with the help of another radio from another mission. But I can't remember how that was arranged.
Now, you mentioned that you had a Captain Ratana of the Bandung Police with you. Was he the staff officer sent by the Thai Divisional Commander? Or was he there on his own account?
He was there on his own account. There was Captain Ratana and also a liaison officer from the 6th Independent Division.
What was Captain Ratana like as a man?
I can't even remember his face today, to be absolutely honest. I couldn't recognise him. I don't know.
It doesn't appear that he made a very deep impression.
Can't have done. No, he can't have done.
Did he come on his own, or was he with men from his police force?
Ratana was on his own, but we did have, and now remember, we did have a Siamese guard, part of the 6th Independent Division, that the commander had left behind to look after us.
How did you get up to the camp?
I remember we left the tin mine on the small gauge railway down to the coast. And with our various boats, a sailing boat, a dugout rowing boat, and finally a steamboat, we landed at a quay in the middle of Bandung about the 5th of early September. So the journey had taken us about 5 or 6 days.
And that was just your party plus the Siamese guard and the police captain?
That is right. And we landed in the middle of Bandung to find the town full of Japanese, and the relationship between the Allies and the Japanese and the Siamese had still at that time not been sorted out.
You say you just pushed through the Japanese.
Just pushed through them. They were all fully armed. Pushed through them with Ratana.
What did they do? Did they show any signs of hostility?
No interest whatsoever. Absolutely no interest.
They were just purely passive.
Purely passive. And I remember we went straight to the police station.
Did you see anything of the Thai civil population?
They were wandering around, I remember. Lovely girls in these lovely long dresses. And chaps just walking around normally. A normal situation with a vast number of passive Japanese fully armed and nobody knowing exactly what they might do. It was an extraordinary situation.
Were there any officers or NCOs who were in charge of the Japanese soldiers, or were they just milling about?
Must have been, but not visible. Not visible. It was rather like Aldershot, full of the Canadian and British Army during the war. It was an extraordinary situation.
What happened to you when you got to the camp, and what did they do with you when you got there?
We were stuck in our little house, I remember talking to the commander and talking to Ratana, and nobody could tell me what was happening, where the Japs were concentrating, what the position was with the Allied prisoners. So I felt that I had to do something to get some information to pass to headquarters and in order to physically do something. So we organised ourselves into two parties. And one party left for Narkon, and the other party went south to Songkhla, where we understood there was to be a Japanese concentration.
Was headquarters pressing you for reports and information at that stage?
I think the answer to that is no. It was our operational order to collect this information, keep headquarters advised. But our contact, as I said, our contact with Ceylon was very intermittent.
Was your journey up to Narkon eventful in any way?
I don't think so. Narkon was the headquarters of the Siamese division. I was escorted up there by the liaison officer, and it didn't, as far as I remember, cause no problems at all.
And what was the situation at Narkon when you got there?
Headquarters. We, by that time, I think the Siamese commander had collected some information, and my other team had also collected information from Song Kla. We prepared a vast series of messages for headquarters, giving all the information we had. This we had to do ourselves. We had to encode the thing. We had to send it off by WT. It took an awful long time. We asked, if I remember rightly, we asked headquarters for permission to visit these Japanese concentrations to assess these, so we could get a first-hand assessment of what it was. But this request was refused, and we were instructed to stand fast and make no official contact with the Japs until ordered.
Had you had any direct contact with the Japs up until that time?
No. Apart from pushing through a bunch of them, no. No contact whatsoever.
When you pushed through that bunch of them, what sort of physical condition did they seem to be in?
Oh, they were in good condition. Respectably dressed, all in uniform, all armed, clean-shaven. Yeah, respectable, yes.
Well-nourished?
Well-nourished, yes. Yes. Yes.
Did you see any signs of distress in the countryside as you were passing through it?
None at all. None at all.
By the time you'd prepared your reports from the information that came in from Song Kla, Narkon, was it clear that the Japanese were not going to resist? Was it clear that they had accepted the imperial order to surrender?
That certainly was our impression. Yes, I think that was our impression. And this is a message that we conveyed to our headquarters, and it was for that reason that we'd requested permission to make physical contact and direct contact with the Japanese commanders in order to arrange formal surrender, collect arms and do all the things that were necessary. But this permission was refused.
Have you any idea why you were ordered not to have any direct or formal contact with them?
I think, Candy, were trying to make up their minds what to do, quite honestly. I don't think they knew what to do. That's the impression I got.
Now, the other area in which I think you had an interest was prisoners of war, Allied prisoners of war. Had you seen anything of any of them?
None at all, no. We had no information at all. We tried desperately hard, but there was no information, and this was another reason why I wanted to make contact with the Japanese.
But I think you say later on you did take the surrender of the local Japanese forces and disarmed them, disposed of their arms.
In the absence of any instructions from Candy, we decided that we had to do something. So we went down to Song Kla and established ourselves in a very nice house, an old British mission on the seafront. The Japanese in the area were most cooperative. We were very well received, very well met. And I took the surrender of the local Japanese division. Sword was formally handed over, which I still have today, actually. And we were given a liaison officer in the name of Captain Kagayama, who turned out to be a pilot belonging to the Port of London Authority. Spoke perfect English. And had lived in England for a long, long time, and was most helpful. Captain Kagayama.
Why did you consider it necessary to disarm the Japanese, then, if they were behaving themselves so well?
I can only assume at that time we had re-established frequent contact with Kandy, and I believe it was done, the collection of the arms and the dumping at sea was done on authority and instructions from Kandy.
Did you discuss the development of the war with Captain Kageyama? Did he express any opinion about the cause of the Japanese predicament?
No, he was very. I think he was very unwilling to talk about the surrender and what might happen. He was entirely happy to do exactly what we wanted. In fact, on the first occasion that we met, I had my desk, a very large desk, in the hall of this rather lovely mission. And there was a knock on the front door, and I shouted, "Come in!" And Captain Kageyama entered, went down on his hands and knees, and covered the whole distance from the front door to my desk on his hands and knees, and sat there, waiting. And I said, "Come on, stand up, for goodness sakes." And after that, the relationship was much improved. But he literally came across on his hands and knees and would not stand until instructed.
What seemed to be the mood of the Japanese soldiers when you disarmed them? Did they appear to be depressed or resigned or cheerful?
Didn't have any contact with them, really. All my instructions to the divisional commander went through Captain Kageyama, who reported daily for instructions. And one instruction was, I remember, "None of us have got our watches. We lost our watches in the drop. Could you please provide 3 watches for us?" The following morning, he came with a suitcase full of watches. He'd collected every watch from every soldier in the division. And we were presented with hundreds of watches and told, "Please make a selection." We selected 3 and the rest of them went back.
Was this division confined to camps and barracks, or were its soldiers wandering about freely?
Camps and barracks outside Songkla. We were given a motor car, we were given the commanding officer's motor car, supplied with petrol. We were given a very nice cook. The food that this old lady found was quite extraordinarily good. Local fish and local fruit. And we were very well looked after. And as far as the dumping of the arms is concerned, I merely told Captain Kabiyawa one morning, "You must collect all the arms of the division. When they're collected, let me know and I will inspect them. You will then arrange for suitable ships. They will be loaded on ships. I will come out with you."